immoral what they do with religion, to my mind. And it's not Jewish, it's un-Jewish.
This is the acid test. This is the reality test. All these values that we've held for all these generations.
If people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet.
There is a way leading from humanity through nationality to bestiality.
3 a.m. and the killing is going on.
Imagine, the United States paying for all this.
First of all, a very warm welcome to you. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a controversial subject and isn't shy to portray Israel in a negative light and even interviews Israelis themselves who are against Israel's policies against the Palestinians and their treatment. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I think it's a little bit patchwork and piecemeal, and that's in part because of the way that this film was produced over the course of 25 years. So there is a sense of a director sort of going back to material and just stitching it together where he can. I think it has moments of real power, and as you say, it does have this new perspective on these events. And I think one of the challenges this conflict has presented to filmmakers is to try and find fresh angles, fresh ways into the conflict that aren't just restating the same old positions time and time and again. And this does find two or three new angles into this conflict that I thought were particularly revealing.
And what are some of those angles?
Well, I mean, getting Israelis to talk about this conflict, and particularly recruiting very calmly spoken, very sympathetic Israelis who have been given at the very least cause to doubt what their rulers have been doing over the past 50 years in particular, and often are openly critical of official state policy. It is obviously a very, very tricky subject, but here there is a sense of filmmaker really going a little bit deeper and finding out that there are little pockets of room to manoeuvre, room for negotiation.
It is refreshing to see.
Yeah, it? Very much so. Very
and
much.
Jonathan, if I can turn to you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, it's very much not a neutral film. It is objective in that it describes quite calmly some very disturbing things. It represents, perhaps not quite proportionally, it represents the views of some of the settlers who are, if you like, the beneficiaries and the perpetrators of many of the wrongs. It does so in order to reveal the inconsistencies in their position and their assumptions, and some of which I think viewers would find is extremely repugnant. But so that when one of the settlers says, oh, there's violence on both sides, I was shot at once, I was shot at in my car with a machine gun, and then he's asked later on, why do you live with your children in this dangerous area? He said, oh, it only happened to once. Yeah. But for Palestinians, it happens every day, not necessarily being shot at, but they are subjugated, humiliated, prevented from going about their daily life, etc. And that is shown very vividly.
We do indeed get a spectrum of opinion and views on this documentary.
The whole world sees the immorality of our of what we're doing and of what we've been doing since we've been occupying the West Bank for 22 years. For two decades, the world didn't see it because the Palestinians seemed willing to live under Israeli rule. That is, they didn't revolt. The children who grew up in that period, seeing their parents bending their heads under Israeli occupation, said to themselves, when I grow up, I'm not going to put up with this. And so began the Intifada.
But I just want to address a point he made. Jonathan, he says that the Palestinians seemed willing, or the older generation, to live under Israeli rule. Surely that can't be right.
I was in Israel in 1956 as a visitor. I visited it not at all for the next 40 years. I don't know, I can't say from first hand what it was, but one can imagine the trauma of this total dispossession, 80% of the Palestinians were forced out. Those that were left often had their villages and their homes destroyed. So one can well imagine that it took time to recover from that. Mm-hmm. And I think the younger generation, which grew up under those circumstances, was then more resilient and said, we don't want to live like this for the rest of our lives. Now, of course, the fact is they have had to live like that for the rest of their lives, and it's getting worse.
And definitely in this film you see this resurgence and this uprising, especially among the youth. And Mike, do you have any thoughts on what Jonathan just said and how the portrayal of the resistance is shown?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly one of the advantages this film has is that it is shot over 25 years, so you do get a sense of not just how long this conflict is going on, but how positions are shifting, how people's perspectives are changing in the course of that quarter century. I do think you get a sense that people are becoming more and more aware that actually for a long time the only way out of this conflict has been death. And I think people are starting to look for avenues, ways out, and to, you know, communicate their position in a way that isn't necessarily violent. And all that comes through in the course of the film.
Of course, in the documentary you also see lots of statistics. It's filmed over 25 years, many historical events that happened during that time. And I just want to touch on a few statistics that the documentary raises, particularly about Palestinian children fatalities in comparison to Israeli casualties. And you can see the difference is stark. So according to the documentary, child fatalities between 2000 and 2014 of Israeli children was something like 133, whereas over 1,400 Palestinian kids were killed by the Israeli side. Does this show then that this is indeed an unequal war?
It's not really a war at all, because it's not a war. A war, you have to have two sides. Here you have basically one side, which can punish the other side at will. Now, I think the suicide bombing was both immoral and it was counterproductive for the Palestinians. So I'm not trying to defend that. But it was a relatively short period when it was realized it was actually reinforcing the tendencies to repression of the Israeli state. So that was cancelled, and I think that is completely right. But people in this country pay attention when Israel is attacking Gaza, and quite a lot of people would know that 2,000 people were killed, more than 2,000 were killed in the last assault in 2014. What they don't realise is that this happens on a small but regular scale every day of the week, and that the numbers killed of Palestinians now in excess of 10,000. So that the assaults on Gaza are less than half of the total of deaths, and that is the price of Israel repressing the Palestinians.
And Mike, do you think that this documentary then portrays the conflict as an unequal conflict, and serves as a good introduction to people who are unaware of what is happening?
Yes, certainly, because it is talking to people on the ground, it is talking to people who are caught up in this conflict, either on one side or the other. So it shows you the way the travel system has been converted in a particular way, so that Israelis are allowed to travel on certain roads, Palestinians aren't. Certain roads are blocked off, walled off. The level of control extends to something like the water supply, and there's a lot of talk in this film about, you know, some people are going without water, other people have enough water to fill a swimming pool.
The settlements have some, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And so what you get in the course of the film is a sense of the level of control that's being imposed over every single aspect of life. To see that is very stark.
It is far-reaching and multifaceted.
The minimum service that the municipality have to give to the people is to take the garbage, to collect the garbage. I don't talk about the roads. You can see the road. I don't talk about the lights. I don't talk about school services and water services. Even water, people, the municipality didn't give them. The municipality said...
No bees at all. There is no bees at all.
This is all done on purpose. Nothing of the occupation happens by chance. No. It happens on purpose. It happens in order to make the Palestinians' life a hell.
We have dehumanized the enemy, as we have been dehumanized only a short time ago. We call them Chayaduaglit, a two-legged animal. We are reenacting without being able to control it. We are reenacting what happened to us as if we've never learned anything.
Very powerful words there. Jonathan, I just wanted to get a quick reaction from you following from that clip of that woman, what she just said, and drawing comparisons between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine.
Yeah, so that in Britain, where we're speaking from, has become a big issue because there's been an attempt to police what you're allowed to say about Israel or Palestine. If you make any such comparison, there will be a whole gang of people on the phone to the papers or the government saying that this is anti-Semitism because you're drawing parallels. But of course we have to draw parallels with those events in history which speak to people. That's our way of making sense of what's happening now. It's not to say that it is the same, it's different, its scale is completely different. The intention is not to annihilate a whole race, but the intention is to demolish a nation, which is slightly different with all of its identifying characteristics, and to steal its land. And one has to be able to make those parallels, just as one makes the parallels with South African apartheid, which is, I think, in this documentary, absolutely starkly evident that it's apartheid in Israel.
And Mike, we were just talking before we went to the clip, actually, about how this documentary portrays how Palestinians are being dehumanized in every aspect of this control system. What other scenes from the film struck out the most to you?
Well, I mean, one of the things this film did was introduce me to a number of the groups who are working within the Middle East to try and resolve this conflict peacefully. So, you know, groups like Blockade Watch and Peace Block, the Women in Black, who are, I think, wives and mothers and daughters who are on the Israeli side, who come out to mourn the losses of you know, all the children killed in the conflict. So there is a sense of people on the ground starting to realise the extent to which this conflict has cost them personally. And, you know, the scenes of mourning are very, very powerful.
And speaking of Israeli settlements, this documentary goes into detail about that and interviews settlers themselves, who we can see are quite vicious in their treatment to the Palestinians. Now, according to reports, around 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 illegal settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds, which is in violation of international law and the United Nations Security Council resolution. And this documentary does a good job of showing various UN resolutions that are being violated. Why, then, is the UN so powerless against Israel?
Oh, well, that's very clear. The UN is unable to pass resolutions which would have teeth, that is to say, which would impose sanctions on Israel without the agreement of all the powers with vetoes at the Security Council. And the United States has vetoed over 40 such resolutions over time. Often it's been the only country in the Security Council voting against a resolution. So it ensures that the so-called international community is absolutely toothless. And countries like Britain or the European Union regularly pass resolutions in Parliament saying, we deplore this, we don't like that. They do nothing because they are unwilling to separate themselves from this very strong United States position. So the whole international community mouths pious words, except perhaps the United States doesn't do it so much, and does nothing. And therefore it's up to the Palestinians themselves who have to endure, and the international civic society, which has to adopt boycott, divestment and sanctions. Well, boycott is what we can do as individuals, as a means of supporting and putting pressure on the Israelis to come to the table and make the concessions necessary for peace.
This village cannot have electricity. You'll see there are electric wires that an NGO put in, but the Israeli military will not allow them to hook up to the electric grid. If you can imagine that kind of racism. I believe if people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet. You know, I've seen the most heinous crimes committed against Palestinians, and my Israeli friends would stand with me in saying the same thing.
the fact that there are Americans who are accepting, tolerating in Israel what they would not tolerate in the United States itself, and American Jews who accept that Israel behave in a way which they would very much object to people behaving in the United States itself, is very bad for Israel.
And Mike, what did you make of this part of the documentary? Was this another refreshing angle to see on this conflict?
Certainly. I mean, it's telling that actually the production company responsible is called Journeyman Films. You can see that this is the work of an American director, a veteran American director, probably wasn't quite as veteran when he first started shooting all this and than when he came out of it. But it is, I think, clearly the work of an American director possessed of a conscience enough to want to bring this conflict back home to America and to show the American people exactly what's going on in this particular part of the world. And it does a very good job of defining this very complex relationship between the US and Israel as we go into the final half hour of the film.
And Jonathan, this film confronts American viewers with a sort of Israeli schism over the country's oppression of Palestine, as well as the U.S. government's responsibility. The documentary says that over $100 billion of taxpayers' money have been spent to Israel, the most than any other country in the world, and the majority of the Security Council vetoes have supported Israel's wars. Do you think this will this documentary will serve as a wake-up call then to Western audiences?
But that very much depends on how widely it gets viewed. And there is a very elaborate and expensive and effective campaign run by the Ministry of Strategic Affairs in Israel to try and blanket the world with propaganda favorable to Israel. And we have, of course, our own domestic in Britain, Israel Lobby, which was shown in a recent documentary. We have the very powerful Israel Lobby in the United States. And the media is very nearly impermeable to these sorts of arguments generally. And that the campaign to persuade people that even relatively mild criticism of Israel is probably motivated by anti-Semitism started in Israel and has been pumped out around the world. And I think the reason is they don't want this message to get out. Now, whether this documentary can make it, I very much hope so. And if so, it will have a powerful effect.
Actually, a point you just made, the documentary mentions about the media and how these Israelis are always portrayed as the victims, whereas the Palestinians are the aggressors, when actually it's the reverse situation.
Yeah.
How responsible does the media, what role do they play in pushing this narrative?
Well, I think they are susceptible to it. And there is a battle going on about language, how you describe things. It's, as Alice said in Alice in Wonderland, it's when Alice says to Humpty Dumpty, you can't use that word, make it mean anything you like, and Humpty Dumpty says, the question is, who's to be master, that's all. And if you can control the language by which something is described, you control the perceptions. And I think that attempt is going on. We have to fight for the right to describe it as it is.
And Mike, would you agree with what Jonathan said? Do you think this documentary will serve as a wake-up call also for Western audiences?
Well, hopefully. I mean, you know, it's getting a pretty small distribution. It's being independently distributed online. It doesn't have necessarily the cinematic heft that we've seen films like Waltz with Bashir and The Gatekeepers, the documentary from a couple of years back, that were all about Israeli people talking about the failings of the Israeli authorities. So it doesn't quite have that cinematic heft. But, you know, if you can find it out, like I say, it does have some really powerful moments.
And if I could just, we're coming to the end of the programme now, if I could get your final thoughts on the documentary and if you'd recommend it.
Oh, it's certainly, you know, this situation is so tricky that, you know, any new perspective that people can find on it, you know, it is worth seeking out for that reason.
And Jonathan, can I get your final thoughts on the film also?
Very striking how little has changed except insofar it's intensified and got worse. You see the interviews and you're not sure necessarily whether it was done in 1989, 1999, 2009. This is a continuing story and we have failed and we have to do better.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid we've run out of time on Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of the show. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
For millions of regular Americans, the end of 2020 was marked by economic distress, with millions suffering pandemic-triggered job losses and thus the loss of their employer-tied health insurance, still waiting on robust economic relief from federal lawmakers and facing a weak social safety net. For the U.S. biggest banks, however, the year closed out with reason for celebration, and they're looking to take advantage of the banner year with a feast of stock buybacks. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Andrea Germanis, journalist. This article is published under the heading, As Economic Suffering Grips Regular Americans, Wall Street Behemoth Ready Feast of Stock Buybacks. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. For millions of regular Americans, the end of 2020 was marked by economic distress, with millions suffering pandemic-triggered job losses and thus the loss of their employer-tied health insurance, still waiting on robust economic relief from federal lawmakers and facing a weak social safety net. For the U.S. biggest banks, however, the year closed out with reason for celebration, and they're looking to take advantage of the banner year with a feast of stock buybacks. As Axios reported recently, banks cashed in on a white-hot IPO market, record debt issuance, and a sky-high trading volume, all of which played out as economic peril softened the consumer side of their businesses. The big picture. Financial results show that banks, which rake in money as middlemen, made a killing thanks to unprecedented action by the Federal Reserve, which caused the rush of activity in financial markets, pushed a slew of companies to issue debt,
and led to a flood of others to go public for the first time. Earnings were particularly sweet for banking behemoths, including J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and Morgan Stanley. Reporting from Bloomberg recently gave a picture of the final quarter. As the banner year for markets came to a close, J.P. Morgan Chase & Co. posted record profit in the fourth quarter, helped by a 20% increase in revenue from trading, a business where it already ranked number one heading into the turmoil. At rival Goldman Sachs Group Incorporation, second only to J.P. Morgan in deal-making, a flurry of transactions helped send its quarterly profit soaring 135%. The results from J.P. Morgan recently and Goldman Sachs mirrored trends in many corners of industry and society during the stocks set off by COVID-19. Strong got stronger. Big banks, Wall Street businesses booming. As the New York Times put it recently, the banks signaled they may take advantage of that windfall by buying back shares, a practice the Fed last month allowed to resume last month, and which critics say simply rewards wealthy shareholders but are essentially manipulation of the stock market. From the Times we read, what do banks plan to do with all that cash? We have so much capital, we cannot use it, Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan told investors. The bank's cash pile has doubled over the past year to more than $500 billion. It's a similar story at other banks, and now that they have been cleared by regulators to resume share buybacks, we're going to be aggressively buying back, and consistently, said James Gorman, Morgan Stanley's chief executive. The reporting came as a new regulatory filing revealed that Dimon, a billionaire, was rewarded in 2020 with the same compensation as in 2019, $31.5 million. In determining Ms. Dimon's compensation, the independent members of the board took into account the firm's strong performance in 2020 and over the long term across four broad dimensions: business results, risk, controls and conduct, client, customer, stakeholder, and teamwork and leadership, the company said. At a conference called earlier this month, Dimon referenced the nation's growing wealth divide. We believe that inequality is a real problem, said Dimon, adding that 40% of Americans make $15 an hour or less. Dimon also pointed to the fact that with the new Biden administration, there will be a new set of regulators whom he expected would be tougher than those in the Trump administration. President Joe Biden, according to reporting recently, is considering naming former Obama Treasury Department official Michael Barr as the nation's top bank cop. As the head of the Office of Comptroller of the Currency, Barr would have the power to regulate banks like J.P. Morgan Chase. Progressive groups like People's Action, however, have urged Biden to instead tap Mara Brotheron, who teaches at the University of California at Irvine Law School and is an expert on the racial wealth gap. Bree Carlson, Deputy Director of People's Action, said in a statement recently of Barr that it's hard to imagine a worse pick, citing his ties to Wall Street and Silicon Valley corporations as reasons for his disqualification. President Biden must prove to voters that the government cares about all of us, not just wealthy elites, said Carlson. If Biden truly wants to build back better, he needs to lock the revolving door and ensure no one with ties to the financial industry is in charge of regulating it.
Debate.
The U.S. President Joe Biden and the Russian President Vladimir Putin have had the first initial contact, and there has been some strides made. First, an agreement on the New START Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, cornerstone of global arms control, was reached. Russia has also reiterated its stance that the U.S. should return to the Iran nuclear deal. Well, in this edition of the debate, we will look at other issues that these two nuclear powers might share, like NATO and Ukraine.
Russia-U.S. relations have generally been tense, with their ups and downs since the end of the Cold War, dragging them into policies and sometimes even conflict. Now a new administration in the U.S. offers a glimmer of hope, with all eyes now on the direction of the bilateral ties the two countries could pursue. In one of the initial moves to reduce tension, U.S. President Joe Biden and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin agreed to extend the 2010 New Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty for 5 more years. The agreement was failed to materialize under former U.S. President Donald Trump, whose administration insisted on a conditional renewal of the accord, which Moscow rejected. The Obama-era agreement puts a limit on the number of strategic nuclear warheads, missiles, and bombers Russia and the U.S. can deploy. The Russian president hailed Washington's move to extend the New START. However, he warned that the situation could still develop unpredictably.
The extension of the START Treaty is definitely a step in the right direction. But I repeat, the situation can develop unpredictably and uncontrollably if, of course, we do nothing to prevent this from happening.
The treaty, which was due to expire on February 5th, provided a rare opportunity for compromise between Moscow and Washington. However, the first phone call between Biden and Putin showed their bilateral disagreements are too wide to resolve. During the call, Biden raised concerns over what he called aggression against Ukraine and warned about Russia's meddling in 2016 U.S. presidential election. He also addressed the reports of bounties on U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan and recent massive cyber hack that has been blamed on Moscow, accusations that Russia has categorically denied. The conversation also included recent protests in Russia in support of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny. This is while the Kremlin accuses the U.S. of promoting anti-government protests in Russia and interfering in its domestic affairs. Following the phone call, the White House, in a statement, reiterated the tough U.S. stance on Russia.
President Biden made clear that the United States will act firmly in defense of its national interests in response to actions by Russia that harm us or our allies.
The Kremlin also issued a statement about the conversation between the leaders of the two countries that underscored troubled relations as well.
President Putin noted that the normalization of relations between Russia and the United States would meet the interests of both countries, and, taking into account their special responsibility for maintaining security and stability in the world of the entire international community.
Can one expect a reset in U.S.-Russia relations while the Biden administration has already inherited thorny ties put in place by his predecessor, even with Washington's close allies? The world will be waiting and watching how Washington and Moscow manage their many differences and seek common ground to avoid escalatory confrontation.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate is Richard Black, former Senator, Virginia State Senate, who joins us from Ashburn. We'd also like to welcome Daniel Kovalik, who's an author, lecturer, and lawyer, joining us from Pittsburgh. I'd like to welcome you both. Richard Black, let me first start with you. So you have this phone call, and you have this initial contact between Putin and Biden. And, well, they had failed to agree an extension under former U.S. President Donald Trump, and I'm referring to the new START Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. What happened under Biden to have this come back that Trump rejected? What were the reasons?
Well, I think, first of all, the extension of the nuclear treaty was obviously a very positive thing. The Russians didn't ask for any preconditions. They just said, let's continue it and let's talk. I think it was a very wise decision for the Biden administration to say, yes, we will look and we will work towards extending it. One of the problems, I supported some things Trump did. I opposed others. I was not a fan of Mike Pompeo. I saw him as less of a diplomat and more of a bully. And his objective was to simply dismantle all of the nuclear treaties that were worked on for decades and decades by generations of good-hearted Americans and good-hearted Russians. So the fact that we're able to hang on to that one treaty, I think, is a very positive thing. Now, in the same conversation, Biden, he is subject to pressures from the deep state, from all of the corporate interests in war. And so he talked about the Navalny poisonings or alleged poisonings, and he raised those issues. He raised some other issues which will keep the deep state satisfied that he's not going to be too friendly. But I think at least there's reason for some hope and some optimism. There certainly is good reason to see improvement in our relations with Iran. And I think to some extent, the Obama administration continues to live on in some fashion. And they saw the JCPOA as being a very major development for them. And I think there's at least a hint that may still be in the works.
Okay, well, we're going to, you touched on a number of issues there. We're going to break those down one by one if time allows us. So, Daniel Kovalik, let me come to you regarding NATO first. In no order of importance here, Biden sought to repair this strained relation that was between the U.S. and Europe by stressing Washington would abide by the NATO treaties, mutual defense pact. Now, do you think that this means that the U.S. is going to continue doing what it's doing with NATO, in which Russia sees NATO as an entity that's encircling it, while at the same time provoking Russia with things like war games?
Yes, I do think that. I think NATO is a relic of the past. It should have been dismantled some time ago. I think Biden's statement that he plans on honoring the agreements with NATO does suggest exactly what you're saying, that Biden plans on continuing to poke the Russian bear, to surround Russia. NATO exists for one purpose and one purpose alone. It was created to counter the Soviet Union. It's been used since the collapse of the Soviet Union to try to counter Russia, and that's what it's going to continue to do, and Biden's making it clear that that will continue.
Okay, so let's continue the path of NATO, Richard Black, in the form of Ukraine, in terms of having your input here. I'm guessing that Biden is going to want to have some kind of settlements or peace settlements on Ukraine. Of course, that issue is very contentious in terms of how he has said repeatedly
that he wants to expand and possibly include, wants NATO to expand and possibly include Ukraine in that picture. How do you think that situation is going to evolve under Biden vis-a-vis Russia and Ukraine?
The main thing that has made it awkward for him is the involvement of his son, Hunter Biden, in some very questionable financial arrangements with Iran. Hunter Biden was just sort of the tip of the iceberg. We have very powerful politicians in Congress whose family members have acquired enormous wealth, and much of that wealth has been by being involved in these never-ending wars, where the United States constantly appropriates money to DOD and CIA and State Department. That money is funneled unaccountably to different companies, and in some cases we see it working its way to people like Hunter Biden. So there's a tremendous vested interest in war. War is our business, and business is thriving. And so it's awkward in Iran, or rather in Ukraine, because we toppled the government in Ukraine some years ago, and we said, well, we're after democracy and so forth, but in fact, we really were looking for conflict and for moving that conflict much closer to the Russian border. But the whole idea of NATO, I certainly agree with your other commentator today. Russia outlived its usefulness and should have been abolished. It should have had a little march and given a medal to everybody in NATO and simply disbanded it at the end of the Cold War. When they didn't, they had to have an enemy. And even though Russia was not an enemy in any respect, it did not have an expansionist philosophy, it didn't have the economic wherewithal to threaten anyone, didn't have the population to do it, and yet it was very necessary to create this boogeyman to justify the tens of thousands of deep staters in NATO and to perpetuate the idea that somehow we had an enemy. We don't have an enemy. Russia is not an enemy. And the only thing that creates hostilities is the fact that we are edging troops right to the very borders of their territorial waters and land, and threatening Russia in a very, very dangerous way, reckless way.
So what about another issue, Daniel Kovalik? Again, one of many that would discuss between these two. And that's the issue of Iran. We know Russia's stance, how it stands on that. I'm not too sure if we understand U.S.'s stance, somewhat murky. But how do you think that Russia would, or how would the U.S. and Russia cooperate with each other when it comes to Iran, even though that is somewhat a moot point because Iran has made its stance very clear when it comes to the Iran nuclear deal?
Well, my hope is that Biden will re-enter that nuclear deal. Iran's made it clear they're willing to do it on day one. I think that will bring back down the temperature between the U.S. and Iran, and frankly bring down the temperature in the Middle East, so I hope that that happens. I think, though, that Israel and Saudi Arabia will be opposed to that, and we'll see if Biden is willing to stand up to those two countries. Trump was not. It's kind of the tail wagging the dog there, and I think it does remain to be seen whether Biden has the fortitude to do that. But I have some cautious optimism that he will, and that he is willing to work with Europe in honoring the nuclear deal, which, you know, Europe is still a party to. So yes, I have some hope.
You had said, Richard Black, just minutes ago, that you don't really see Russia, if I understood you correctly, to be the threat that it's been perceived to be, something that has been somewhat formed by the way that EU views Russia, perhaps, countries like the UK. And Russia, of course, has been accused of doing some things to make that scenario, or to create that scenario. But we're looking at Biden, who once called Putin soulless. I mean, do you think that Biden will approach Russia in an offensive way in terms of dictation? Or will it look it to be somewhat of an ally, which is very hard to actually conceive?
It is almost impossible to make an ally of Russia so long as we have this vast, deep state of NATO operatives in place. All of them, their jobs, their wealth, their position, all depend on having an enemy. And so that is the problem with truly forming an alliance with Russia. In a world without NATO, there is no reason that Russia could not join and become an integral part of Western Europe. Their values are similar. In fact, their new constitution provides that marriage is one man and one woman. It provides for parents' rights over the upbringing of their children. These are things that Americans have struggled to get for generations and couldn't get, and yet they exist in Russia. Russia is totally compatible with Western Europe. They're trying to extend the Nord Stream 2 pipeline to Germany. Germany wants it very badly. Russia wants it very badly. The United States is sanctioning and going contrary to the countries of the European Union on this issue. I see a very natural, very comfortable relationship if we were to drop the militarization. Some people say, well, look, Trump achieved something great because he got the NATO countries to increase their defense spending. For what purpose? Now, I can see some concerns about threats from Turkey, but I do not see any threat from Russia. Russia is no threat whatsoever to Europe, and the whole thing is just a piñata to give us something to strike at.
Okay, well, Daniel Kovalik, we talked about NATO here, we talked about Iran, we talked about Ukraine, but then we take a look at the issue of Navalny. Now, you know, when Russia has come out accusing the U.S. directly of backing demonstrations and protests for Navalny, then obviously that rattles the cage of Putin in a sense, if he does have a cage. And that's, you know, in a sense, an interference, if I'm correct to make that assessment. So it doesn't make grounds for what the Kremlin wants, which is a normalization of relations between Moscow and Washington. That's something the Kremlin has come out and said. So is there a limit as to the way these two countries are going to get along when you have the U.S. been accused of it, which, it has been accused of this accusation in other countries, which holds true?
Yeah, I mean, look, the U.S. claiming that Russia interfered in the 2016 election, which, by the way, I feel is a dubious claim, is at best the pot calling the kettle black. I mean, the U.S. has interfered, we know, in, 81 different elections throughout the world. This has been documented. And that doesn't even count the times that the U.S. has actually overthrown governments by force and by coups. So, yes, I would not be surprised if the U.S. Was supporting these demonstrations. They're clear from the media that I listen to every day that they support Navalny, even though, frankly, I've seen some statements by him that suggest he's a right-wing racist. But again, that's not surprising. The U.S. backed neo-Nazis in Ukraine, you know. So, as long as the U.S. decides it can meddle in other countries like Russia, but then takes umbrage at countries allegedly interfering here, I just think it's not a grounds for a mutual relationship.
There are other hot spots that these two countries need to figure something out on, Richard Black. One of them is Syria. They need to come to some kind of understanding on that. And of course, when we talk about West Asia, Middle East, as it's called, then there also needs to be an understanding there, because Russia does not share all common interests with the U.S. when it comes to this region. How will that be resolved? And we could start by talking about Syria.
You know, the most insightful thing that I saw was put out by Atlantic Council not recently, or rather recently. Atlantic Council is very much a deep state organization, but their analysis was good. And they said that a couple of things. They said Tony Blinken, who is the proposed Secretary of State, has said that public support for U.S. hegemony is diminishing. He suggested that, at least in the short term, Russia and Iran will control the trajectory of events in Syria. Now, he did say that he was going to increase aid to the areas of Idlib province and the Kurdish-occupied northeastern Syria. Now, this means that we will be providing additional enhanced aid to al-Qaeda and to the terrorists that occupy Idlib province. Unfortunately, one of the saddest things is that we have had a consistent policy of starving the Syrian people. Through our sanctions and through devaluing the currency through the SWIFT system, we've created enormous inflation. We have cut off the Syrian people from their major source of wheat that they need for bread. We have stolen their oil, which they need to heat homes in the winter. We've even managed through our extensive sanctions to block the Syrians from receiving medicines to treat cancer and other diseases. Anyone who says that sanctions are designed to simply, twist the arms of wealthy, powerful politicians is a fool. Mm-hmm. The purpose of sanctions is to crack down on common people, and that's what they do.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. We're going to have to end it there. That was Richard Black, former senator of Virginia State Senate. Thank you for your statements. And also, Daniel Kobalik, thank you, author, lecturer, and lawyer from Pittsburgh. That does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mikawa Taiwan, the entire team in the capital of Taiwan, it's goodbye. Until next time.